You are listening to the Krika Lecture Series podcast, produced by the Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This and other Krika podcasts are available on SoundCloud and iTunes. For more information about Krika's lecture series and public events, visit our website at krika.wisc.edu.
Jennifer, and it's a great pleasure for me to welcome Komaromi on campus. And as some of you know, or even those who were not here in 2001, including myself, this is when Anne received her PhD from the Department of Slavic Languages and Literatures. And since, I believe, 2005, Anne has been teaching at the University of Chicago. She is now a professor at the Center of Comparative Literature and in the Department of Slavic Languages and Literatures at the University of Chicago. And
Chicago?
It was Toronto. At the University of Toronto.
Didn't make it to Chicago.
No, it's north of Chicago. Anne's first book had a title, Uncensored, and it was devoted to the topic of Samizdat novels and the quest for autonomy in Soviet dissidents. And that book, some of those present here definitely read it. Was focused on three very important figures and three very important texts of Russian Soviet, late Soviet literature that initially were published in Samizdat by Andrei Bitov, Indik Tirafeev, and Vasily Aksyonov. And I will not talk more about that book because otherwise my introduction will take up too much time of our lecture period. And second book that just came out last year in 2022 from Cornell University Press is entitled Soviet Samizdat, Imagining a New Society. And I'll say just a few words about this book before Anne starts her talk about that book. In Soviet Samizdat, compared to her first book, Anne Komaromi significantly broadens the scope of her material. It no longer comprises just literary samizdat or its single exemplars, but rather includes a vast and variegated range of publications produced by poets and religious groups, national minorities and feminists, right activists and Marxist dissenters. The diversity of this material dictates definitely a very novel approach proposed by Anne in that book to treat Samizdat as an alternative textual culture that facilitated the formation of new public communities in the Soviet Union after Stalin. And this reshaping of the subject seamlessly removes the rigid opposition of official and unofficial culture as well. The actors of Samizdat and their readers obviously partook in both. Komaromi's primary research question has to do with the sense of purpose that informed the activities of Samizdat communities and how these communities transformed the social fabric of the post-Stalin USSR. So with this, I would like to welcome Anne again, and please help me welcome her.
Thank you so much, Irina, and thank you also, Jennifer, and the whole Krika team for bringing me here to talk with you today. I appreciate the generous introduction, and I'm afraid that, Irina, you probably described the book better than I will, but I hope that I can at least raise some questions, maybe going in various directions, and see what you might like to discuss. So I'll try not to torture you too much with my long explication of the journey of how this book came to be, but I'm so glad to have the opportunity to do this because It's very special for me to come back to Madison, where I did my graduate studies. I was fortunate to work with stellar faculty and fellow students who really inspired my work and supported me in many ways. And this is the recent book, which came out in 2022. Samizdat, as many of you know, is a term coined for self-publishing in the Soviet Union after Stalin, sometimes called underground press. Samizdat was not like pre-revolutionary underground press in that it did not directly challenge the government nor call for regime change, at least not generally. It did, however, give Soviet readers alternative ways of imagining themselves and their society. So my research over more than a couple of decades has focused on researching and conceptualizing this alternative publishing system. And I'll tell you a little bit about how that developed to become the interdisciplinary study presented in this book. The research really is a response to the character of Samizdat texts, which more obviously than most, I think, provoke us to think about their materiality and their often precarious life as creations produced and circulated through social networks. So the plan of the talk is to tell you a little bit about identifying the material, that is, the process of deciding what the material would be at different stages, and then locating it and describing it. And I'll discuss, after that, methods of research and communication. So these are research methods that range from the literary to the historical, including the book historical, and methods of scholarly communication that have included a mix of digital and print publications of the research. And finally, I'll talk a little bit about the conceptualization, that is to say, the theory and concepts I used to make sense of my research findings. While Samizdat did not bring down the regime, it did, I argue, create a positive basis for grassroots renewal of society and culture in the Soviet Union. So when I started here in graduate school in the Slavic department, working on language and literary works, that led to a dissertation focused on discrete novels. These were the three Samizdat novels written from the mid-1960s to the mid-1970s, mentioned by Irina. The Burn by Vasily Aksyonov, Pushkin House by Andrei Bitov, and Moscow Stations, one of the translations of Moskva Petushki by Venedikt Yerefeyev. I was thinking about what the genre of the novel signified in terms of these authors' ambitions to write books that would sum up and characterize their generation and the era after Stalin. The relation of these novels to the authors' biographies was very important in this regard and became a focus for me. I was also studying the style and structure of these literary works and devoting a lot of time to understanding the dense web of allusions in them. Allusions to world literature and classic 19th century Russian works, references to Soviet films, radio culture, slang, and jokes. And my dissertation supervisor, Yuri Shiglov, was an extraordinary mentor, helping me to develop the cultural competence, as he put it, on which these novels drew. These were all the things that the immediate audience of the time in the Soviet Union, and I would compare this to Dante's audience in early 14th century Tuscany, knew and understood. You don't have to know all of the details in order to appreciate the work, but there's a richness to and significance within the specificity of all of those allusions that that matter for what these authors are doing. Shiglov also analyzed humorous strategies employed by the authors, including the displacement of material from one sphere to another, the lowering of highly serious authoritative voices, and etc. Some of you know that Shiglov did this kind of study of Ilf and Petrov's classic satirical novels, The Twelve Chairs and The Golden Calf, and I was very lucky to have him with this expertise to guide me. because part of what intrigued me about these novels was their use of irony and humor. The serious and tragic works by Solzhenitsyn and Akhmatova were much better known as monuments of the Stalin era and de-Stalinization. But the novelists on which I was working were also reckoning with the Stalinist legacy, doing it in a different way. And they used this humor and irony in unexpected and powerful ways. It was not simply satire. As I understood it, they were reflecting on and unsettling received ways of thinking about themselves and about Soviet society with the serious aim of provoking the possibility for change. The other thing that fascinated me, and which I had trouble understanding, was the status of these works as samizdat. Both Aksyonov and Bitov had been published officially and hailed as promising authors of a new wave of youth prose in the USSR. But they chose to write their big novels, these major artistic statements about their time and their generation, as samizdat, and to have them published abroad as tamizdat. Clearly, they wanted to address taboo topics, the Stalinist camps and returnees, anti-Semitism and drinking and sex. But there was something else about what it meant for these authors and their readers to communicate in this uncensored fashion. They could be more honest, yes. They could use dirty words, many, and portray a rather gritty Soviet reality, for sure. But these authors were also taking a stand as free thinkers and independent voices, and then modeling this for their readers, not just in what they said, but in how they wrote and shared it. After the Pasternak affair, it was clearly risky to publish works this way, but there was also a growing network of people to appreciate and support uncensored publication. Handling all three of these dense novels was too much for the dissertation, and I ended up focusing on Yerofeyev's novel alone. But later, I continued studying the context and the content, and I expanded my research of the samizdat-tamizdat system. I looked at archived copies of the texts in North American collections, such as the Artist Archive. I worked on material from collections in Moscow. And I continued talking to archivists and editors, artists, and poets about what they had written or done and what they had to say about samizdat texts. People, including poet and artist Dmitry Prigov, had plenty of observations about a form of the text that had become widespread and widely fetishized by the 1970s. People joked about the grandmother who couldn't get her grandson to read Tolstoy's War and Peace, and therefore went to great lengths typing the whole novel out for him, just so he would be interested in it. I finished my dissertation in 2001, but I published my book Uncensored in 2015. I do not recommend taking so long to finish a first book, but the intervening years, which, to be fair, were filled with some other things, a couple of big moves, lots of new courses to develop, program coordination, some published articles, the birth of two kids, did allow me to work up a study of the three novels that included analysis of the field of unofficial late Soviet culture and cross-border dissemination. This meant that in addition to the properly literary study of the works, the way the novels were put together, and the way they creatively reflected the lives of the authors who wrote them, I could pursue historical study of the archived documents of those works and others, and do interviews with authors, editors, readers, and archivists of samizdat. This historical research was, in fact, a lot of fun. I was talking with all kinds of people, the Archbishop of Lithuania, a rock music icon, famous poets, a woman who packaged kosher meat in her bathtub. I was also visiting archives and documenting samizdat works that in many cases only a few people had ever seen. I told people afterwards about the kind of obsession and thrill of finding things. It was sort of like spotting rare birds, because some of them were very colorful, though this was not necessarily common given the difficulty of reproducing such images without color copy technology. Some of them looked like Frankenstein texts. And there were a few examples of publications that were not made with typewriters and hands alone. The typewriters, you know, that was much more widespread and typical. But publications of unregistered Baptists, for example, and they were dispersed in less populated areas of the Soviet Union and able to conceal printing presses and hectograph machines. So these were among the things I found as well. And by the 1980s, the rock zines featured collage and Xeroxed pages as well as handmade elements. These were visually striking, and they highlighted the intermedial character of communication in what was otherwise a very logocentric culture. This intermediality was true also of the creations of artists Sergei Sigay and Ri Nikanova, who moved around provincial cities and organized neo-avant-garde groups and activity wherever they were. Their Samizdat journals, Nomer and Transparence, along with dozens or really, I think, hundreds of Samizdat books, are among the star materials at the Research Center for the Study of Eastern Europe in Bremen. The Russian Center at Amherst College also recently acquired another large portion of the artist's archive. The archive at FSO, the Forschungsstelle Osteuropa, or Research Center for East European Studies at Bremen University in Germany, became particularly important for me. They had many things not found anywhere else. This included a lot of literary and art periodicals which had not been published in the two big reprint series, Собрание документов Самиздата, the collection of Самиздат documents, and Материалы Самиздата, the materials of Самиздат, which came out of Radio Liberty Munich and their Самиздат department. The Radio Liberty Samizdat collection was in the Open Society Archive in Budapest by the time I was doing research, and its focus was on rights groups, national movements, and other materials with obvious socio-political implications. Another very significant portion of the research took place in community archives, such as that of VAD Russia, and in collections put together by community historians in Israel. These people were, like the archivists at some of the bigger institutions, including Keston College and the FSO, former activists who helped produce and or smuggle Samizdat. Those who participated in the history felt a special identification with it and concern for it. There was much to learn about what, how, and why they had curated these collections. And the fate of such collections, like the fate of other non-state and even state archives, is a complex question and I think a very contemporary one that interests me. I'm happy to talk more about some of that. I also had significant conversations with colleagues in different fields. The medievalists, in particular, had good tips. Samizdat had been compared to a pre-Gutenberg manuscript system by Anna Akhmatova and many others after her. And in the mid-2000s, the medievalists were early adopters of digital humanities technologies. They understood immediately the advantages of digitizing rare or unique manuscripts with visual as well as textual information. The value of this technology was also clear for Samizdat, especially in the case of illustrated editions, which kind of resemble illuminated manuscripts, although obviously very much in their own way. Digitizing them would help capture rare and unique and fragile copies. And make them safely and easily accessible to researchers. Eventually, I bought a camera and some basic equipment, and we simply photographed Samizdat journals. I sent a research assistant, Anastasia Kostryukova, who just defended her PhD successfully at NYU, to photograph many of these in Bremen. It was a pretty do-it-yourself endeavor, and thus relatively cheap. Relatively. So DH tools were a great fit for my research topics, and I was lucky to catch the wave of growing interest in digital humanities, which made my projects attractive to granting agencies. Because, of course, as you might imagine, my travel to Russia, to Lithuania, to Germany, to California, to Israel, and the UK and the hiring of research assistants for many hours of work, and people to, whom I sent to Texas, to St. Petersburg, to Kiev, all of this required funds. And many of those funds came from the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada. This is one of the things that was possible because I could send my research assistant to Kiev to take the interview. In the archives, the collections were vast, and the idea of cataloging all of Samizdat, which people were talking about quite a lot at the time, seemed quixotic. So I decided to focus on Samizdat journals and other periodical editions because that seemed feasible enough. And it allowed me to investigate the variety of materials and topics represented there. Also, those periodicals had the advantage of showing what communities had sort of developed to the stage of expressing themselves and, wanting to create this kind of public feedback loop. So the outcomes then were some published articles, and by 2011, an online database of Soviet Samizdat periodicals. This was just bibliographic information, and it's hosted at University of Toronto Libraries. It was something I was able to do with my research assistants and the support of the information technology staff at our university library. A few years later, in 2015, we launched the Project for the Study of Dissidents in Samizdat. This project site encompassed the database and other elements. Those other elements included bilingual interviews, an illustrated timeline of rights activism, a timeline of the Jewish movement, as well as story maps devoted to topics like the artist pair Sige and Nikonova. The most outstanding feature of the project site are the electronic editions. These are digitized full issues of a set. This is not all of them. There are just over 20 titles of Samizdat periodicals that came mainly from the previously unpublished literary and art journals held at FSO Bremen. I signed a contract with them to do this, and after some rather protracted negotiations, but I think they've been pleased to have this small set of their materials to show people and offer to researchers through the Toronto site. So these digital resources have helped support the study of late Soviet culture as a growing research field, but it was important also to publish the results and the analysis in other forms. One of the organizations formally collaborating for the online database and project site was the International Memorial Society. Together with my longtime collaborator there, Gennady Kuzovkin, we published a print version of the catalog of Soviet Samizdat periodicals in Russian in 2018. This made the data more accessible to Russophone researchers. It also meant that the data would be fixed and available for decades into the future. Unfortunately, even the most well-supported and institutionally stable online resources, like those hosted at University of Toronto Libraries, do not afford that kind of longevity. Websites and digital tools age. They age quickly. They require technical curation and migration every few years. This is expensive, and it's certainly beyond the capacity of someone like me to manage. Resources have to be found for the whole lifetime of the site. And in December, I have scheduled a talk with the information technology staff team, which will include the rather anxiously named end of life issues we have to discuss. It has been particularly important to discuss this fact with my collaborators and community partners. Putting up a personal website with data collected and thinking it would just be there forever is a mistake. Sites require a lot of time and effort, and they are unstable without institutional backing. Even with institutional backing, they won't last forever. Print and paper documents, when well curated, are more stable. Mm-hmm. Thinking about what different media mean, the values and the practices associated with them, what they promise to do and what they physically can do has been central to my analysis of Samizdat as a system, which relied mostly on low-tech typewriters, hands, and personal networks. In some ways, those grassroots means were very powerful in implementing freedom of speech and thus affecting minds and influencing new forms of cultural and social imagination. In other ways, they were fragile and ephemeral, like butterfly wings that threaten to disintegrate as we hold or look at them. My methods for the first book were thus literary and historical, as I said, and the theoretical apparatus coalesced around the sociological methods of Pierre Bourdieu. Bourdieu's description of the field of art in bourgeois society and his coining of terms like symbolic capital provided ways to think about how the field of Samizdat culture was constructed and what kind of conversions between symbolic and real capital happen when Samizdat works travel. But I was troubled from the start, and partly because of the good training I had here at Madison, by the idea of using Western European thinkers to explain Eastern European realities. Part of the way I addressed that problem was to work out what I saw as the impact of the Soviet case on our understanding of ideas Bourdieu discussed, such as autonomy. We can talk more about that if you're interested in it. But the more recent book reflected work that had been in progress for a long time and a somewhat different conceptual apparatus. It included an appendix that presented in English all the data collected about Soviet Samizdat periodicals so that that would be available in a stable print version there as well. And it fleshed out the conceptual sketch from the article I published in 2012 on Samizdat journals and publics. The discussion of Samizdat publics seemed to go along well with the focus on print culture and its others. That thinking about print and non-print cultures arose out of the comments of Samizdat authors and readers. In addition to Akhmatova's famous comment about a pre-Gutenberg condition, we have conceptualist poet Lev Rubinstein's elliptical remarks about the extra-Gutenberg existence of the text in an unofficial culture. So these were some cues for me. The Samizdat public sphere I had documented was pluralized with many different communities, each of which imagined itself as in some way alternative to the existing official Soviet culture, though not necessarily opposed to it, rather constructively oriented to a future version of their society that would include the values it espoused. The self-understanding of any given Samizdat community involved some variable mix of collaboration with and distinction from other Samizdat publics around it. So it wasn't just about the relationship to official society and the regime, it was about Samizdat publics in relation to other Samizdat publics. I referred in my analysis to established debates about the public sphere that run from Habermas to Fraser and Warner. Publics are mediated through texts. This idea resonates with Benedict Anderson's description of imagined communities, and that has been part of what Charles Taylor and Dipesh Chakrabarty have talked about as a modern social imaginary that is not one and unified in the West, but in fact made up of multiple modernities around the globe. And so, like Lefort and Yurchak, I don't see Soviet socialism in this period as the opposite of Western society so much as another species of late modernity with its own contradictions and hybrid forms. I added also Bakhtin's notion of chronotope as adapted from his original discussion of the topic, but based on a remark he made about how the creation of a space-time complex could occur not only within literary works, but also in the social life of works between authors and readers over time. Samizdat journals, I proposed, helped both describe and construct alternative chronotopes where authors and readers could imagine themselves with new capacities and possibilities. I think a couple of examples might help illustrate some of what I mean. The Chronicle of the Catholic Church in Lithuania ran for an astounding 81 issues between 1972 and 1989. The Lithuanian Republic had an exceptionally well-developed samizdat space of production and circulation, thanks largely to the Catholic Church. Some of those samizdat journals did things like review the history of Lithuanian people to World War II and before from an independent perspective. There was one journal that even looked back to pagan times in the country, which was something some people were researching and thinking about. The Lithuanian Chronicle was like the Moscow-based Chronicle of Current Events. That was the major publication of so-called democratic dissidents. In that, both chronicles covered abuses of rights and efforts by citizens to assert rights. In this way, both of them reconfigured the present as a time when independent action and agency were thinkable and meaningful. Activists passed the Lithuanian Chronicle to Moscow dissidents for translation into Russian and for smuggling out of the country. And abroad, it was published in Lithuanian and in English translation. Both the Moscow and the Lithuanian Chronicles featured fact-based reporting. However, the distinctive concerns and style of the Lithuanian Chronicle might be appreciated in the following episode. In issue 14 from 1975, we hear about a teacher, Mrs. Aukšti Kalniene of grade 7B at the J. Janonis Middle School of Šiauliai, who assigned a pupil, Miss R. Vaitkuta, to lead an hour on atheism. The mother of the pupil came to school to talk with the teacher about the assignment. "We are Catholics, and my daughter will not conduct such a lesson," the mother objected. "If you were an old woman, I would not be surprised," said the teacher, "but you are a young woman. You should not bring up your children so badly." "No, my children will never be atheists," declared the mother. And I think this is interesting because it's a sort of everyday encounter, right? It includes conflict, but not arrest or punitive action. There isn't any suggestion that that's what happened. And that would really be what would be required, I think, to bring it up to the level of the Moscow Chronicle. This was meant for the specific readership of the Lithuanian Chronicle, which was concerned with expressing Lithuanian identity and conscious of the myriad ways that that expression had been suppressed in the USSR. The framing of the incident emphasizes its verifiability. We have the name of the city, Šiauliai, which is up here in the sort of north-central portion of the republic. We have a rough date. We have the names of the people involved, which I think is very important. It suggests that readers could hear about this from other people. Maybe some even know the family and could hear about it from them. And the willingness of the family to go on record with their name, Vaitkuta, and this defiant statement demonstrates that they overcame the fear and scorn promoted by Soviet officials in all kinds of minor as well as more grand official ways against religious believers in the press and other public settings, including school. The incident demonstrates attainable behavior and self-possession. Far from being sort of established community spokespersons or dissidents under arrest, the schoolgirl and her mother assert a Lithuanian Catholic identity in ordinary and familiar ways, and they model that kind of action for readers. Another example of a particular samizdat public and the alternative social imagination it fostered can be found in rock fanzines. These samizdat publications straddled the line between official and unofficial, elite and mass cultures. They told the story of Soviet rock music, which provided readers with an alternative chronology that combined landmarks in British, American, and international rock history with important moments in the development of domestic rock. Samizdat zines recorded and also helped make the history of this subculture, and in particular, the appearance of the Leningrad rock journal Roxy, which ran from 1977 to 1990. You know, when it came out in the late 1970s, this sort of marked the consolidation of a domestic Soviet rock subculture. This modest-looking journal, which initially consisted of a couple dozen pages stapled together with three or four poor quality photos pasted in, featured impressive content. Among others, Boris Grebenshikov, leader of the influential Soviet rock band Aquarium, wrote for Roxy. And the journal fostered a homegrown subculture, complete with its own slang and its own style. And I'm sure many of you know more about this than I do. Editors described the impulse for the journal in terms of the joy of human contact. They said, quote, "To make a journal all together and feel ourselves to be among like-minded people was a way of getting our kicks, will of kife. And therefore, the most important thing in the journal became that idea of pure kicks, idea chistova kaifa. The slang term kaif, kicks, pleasure, high, helped mark out the boundaries of the group of like-minded fans, marked by this distinctive style of discourse with its own slang and other characteristic behavior." Excuse me. An important part of the verbal style in Roxy and Soviet rock subculture generally was styob, a type of mockery characterized by deadpan delivery that suggests identification with the discourse being imitated. Such mockery, which might manifest as over-identification with official Soviet values or a fixed literary style or an emotional affect, should be done well enough that it remains detectable only to those in the know. In this way, styob served to distinguish the in-crowd who got the joke from the straight man or square who did not. Alexei Yurchak, in his well-known account of late Soviet culture, asserted that styob avoids any stance of support or opposition. In my view, Yurchak's analysis downplays the positive aspect of rock styob, which consisted of affiliation with the subcultural group and its values, as distinct from the rest of Soviet society, often referred to in these types of publications as the socium. Boris Grebenshikov wrote about those who get rock music in his article On Getting It, Vrubya, in the first issue of Roxy. The epigraph to the piece, which was in English, came from a Western article. It said, quote, "In a study of six children with behavioral or emotional problems, amplified rock music, mainly by the Beatles, has interrupted disruptive behavior. The children were also observed synchronizing their movements to the music as they expressed their enjoyment of the music." So getting it, associated with overcoming destructive impulses and attaining peace and harmony through music, in some ways, this image of disturbed children in the process of finding healing resonates, I think, with this well-known debate about fathers and sons in the 1960s. That's a debate that harkens back, of course, to the 19th century. And this was about the post-Stalin generation. The generation of children distinguished themselves from the culpable parents of the Stalinist generation, but they had to reckon with the persistent trauma and Stalinist impulses found in their own time, and indeed even within themselves. Vasily Aksyonov and others had dealt with the question of generations in those terms. Those would be too political and specific to find in a place like this, but I think there's a sort of resonance in the fact that these are our children who are getting over some impulses to disruptive behavior. In Grebenshikov's piece, the solidarity of those who love and get this music obviously transcends Soviet conditions. The advantage of music is that it can unite people in enjoyment and harmony beyond linguistic and social divisions. And Grebenshikov suggested that getting it was salutary because it superseded other superficial and harmful distinctions. Quote, "People are distinguished according to racial characteristics or by national belonging. There exist big groups of people who are distinguished according to whether they control the means of production. People are also distinguished according to their attitude to rock music. Some get it, and some don't. There are more of the latter." To this day, it remains a mystery whether anything unites those who get it, except the fact that they get it. The in-group of those who get it is thus not defined by fixed or pre-given boundaries. It's an open and inclusive notion of a community of people united by love of this music and committed to its beneficial effects. The space of this community of fans is thus notionally international and capable of overcoming divisions. In practice, Samizdat rock scenes crossed and crisscrossed the USSR. They were much more geographically widespread. The production of them was, and the dissemination. They were produced in many provincial cities, as well as in Leningrad and Moscow. People exchanged them at festivals, and they even sent them through the regular mail, which was something rather unusual for Samizdat. Hyper-intellectual rock journalists appeared in the pages, as did straightforward fan reporting. There were critical reviews. There were enthusiastic reviews. There was something for everyone and space for a lot of different voices and registers. So I hope these very different examples give you some sense of how Samizdat journals and other periodicals helped foster alternative publics and the creative social imagination they represented. That social imagination was pluralized, with groups staking claims not just for human rights or civil rights, but also for national and religious expression, for countercultural values of peace and mental health, as well as for aesthetic freedom, intellectual freedom, and the freedom of movement, among other things. I think it's important to say that our recent global experience with digital and social media has shown that extra Gutenberg communications do not necessarily lead to good or constructive outcomes. They may erode established authority and social consensus and the basis for a shared reality and social trust along with them in ways that open the door to bad commercial and political forces. For that reason, however, we may do well to consider the example of the relatively low-tech version of extra Gutenberg culture found in Soviet Samizdat, where people took calculated risks, fostered bonds of social trust and shared responsibility. They cultivated, for the most part, mutual respect across differences and broadly maintained a substantial commitment to fact-based claims in the spirit of resistance to totalitarian tendencies and violence. It's worth asking why they were able to do so. And I think we must consider that Soviet education and infrastructure and experience were formative for Samizdat authors and readers, not only as a negative foil for these qualities, they also provided the basis for positive aspects of Samizdat culture. How might we today foster creative expression and social imagination that resist the totalitarian tendencies and violence we still face? Sure, but Samizdat helps me think it might be possible.